This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
One of the things that has troubled me enormously for a number of years and continues to do so is, and I think we've spoken about it on occasion in this year, is the apparent situation where when non-religious people become religious, when people become frum, there are a lot of wonderful things that happen and they start keeping mitzvahs and so on. But there's also something they seem to lose. And that's very disturbing. It shouldn't be so. There's almost a diminution of personality that takes place. You find nice people who are lively and outgoing and extrovert and bright and all sorts of ideas and creative. And they become frum and they become serious. And they lose their sense of humor, and they start becoming oppressed, and sometimes depressed, and they become smaller than they used to be. In personality, they lose. And there's something wrong if that's happening. The opposite should happen. When a person becomes frum, he should become bigger. He should expand. It seems to be a contraction that takes place instead of an expansion. And people seem to accept it. I don't accept it, but people seem to accept it. That's normal, that's understandable. It's true that becoming frum creates certain limitations. It's true that there's certain things that one used to be able to do that one can know that one is no longer able or permitted to do. But the sacrifice in range should be made up by the new accumulation of depth possibilities. The sacrifice in physical experience and material experience should be made up by the acquisition of enormous spiritual and intellectual experience. While some physical experiences have to be diminished, but they're nothing compared to what is gained. One can still eat, it's just that there's certain food that you can't eat, but there's substitutes, and today keeping kosher isn't so difficult. One can still go all sorts of places. On Shabbos one can't. So one day a week, there's a certain restriction. Yeah, there's certain places one used to go to that one can't go to anymore. But look what one gains. A world of intellectual and spiritual exploration that should open limitless horizons to a person. And the process that one should see, you should be able to notice that a person has become frum, not by the fact that he's... nowadays there are two ways you notice that he's become frum. He starts wearing a yarmulke. He takes his tzitzis out, and then he starts looking a bit untidy, and then he starts putting on a bit of weight, then he grows a beard, then he starts wearing a hat, then when he's really made it, he wears his yarmulke hanging out of the back of his hat, so that you can see he's wearing a yarmulke and a hat, and that's how you see he's become frum. And you see that he's become more serious, and he's lost his sense of humor, and he's losing his personality, and his ability to interact successfully with people of different viewpoints, he becomes less sure of, and he starts becoming generally a less adequate person, except when he's in his religious environment. When he's within his religious environment, he's completely secure, he knows what to do, he knows what's expected of him, and he feels fantastic. The moment he's outside of his religious environment, he looks like a freak. And all sorts of reasons have been given for that, and some people say that it's ideal for people, it justifies looking like a freak. You can look like a freak and you don't even have to take responsibility from it because you're frum. It justifies putting on weight. You can be fat. Nobody notices that part and nobody sees that. It justifies not being dressed well. It justifies bad behavior sometimes. They're non-frum. They don't understand. They're irreligious people. You can write everything off that way. You can carry on your own happy way, do your own happy thing, and be quite self-satisfied that what you're doing is good and right, even though the world thinks you're a kook. The reason the world thinks that I'm a kook is because they're not religious. And we've discussed before how the Gemara says, if you want to know whether you're a kook or not, don't look in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch won't be able to help you. If you want to know whether you're a kook or not, ask the man in the street. He's the guy who knows whether you're normal. He doesn't know whether you're a tzaddik or not. That he can't comment on. He doesn't know whether you're a moral person or you're not a moral person. For that, you look in the Shulchan Aruch. But if you want to know if you're normal, stop people in the street and say, do you think I'm normal? Tell me the honest truth. And if the guy says, no, I think you're a kook, then go and see a psychiatrist because he's right. And you are a kook. That's it. Mahabriyas Oimreis Allah. As the Gemara says, ask humanity, ask ordinary people what they think of you, and then you'll get a fairly clear perception as to whether you're normal or you're abnormal. And I think a lot of religious people, again, I'm talking about religious people not because it applies only to them, certainly not. There's no shortage of kooks in the non-religious world, or in the non-Jewish world. It's just that it shouldn't be in the religious world. Religion should, Torah should inculcate a normality in people. It shouldn't inculcate absurdity in people. And if the man in the street looks at the religious person and says he's absurd, then he is absurd. It doesn't help that he's religious. Then he's a religious madman, that's all. It doesn't mean because you're religious you don't qualify for a madhouse. You can have religious people in a madhouse also. It doesn't mean anything. People seem to assume if I'm frum, I'm okay. And if everybody else thinks I'm a sugar, it's because they're not religious. They don't understand. So everything's fine. And one can go on one's own merry way. It isn't so. If one isn't able to interact with the world in a way where people look and are able to look up to the person and say, Ashrei Oviv Shilim Da Teiro, Ashrei Rabbi Shilim Da Teiro, people in the street should say, what a lucky man. What a lucky woman. Look how wonderful they are. Look how normal they are. Look how fine and noble they are. Aren't they lucky they've got the Torah? That should be the response. When the response is, if that's what it is to be frum, I don't need it. That's the opposite. And that's the route that we're often taking. Often the kind of people we're developing are not kind of people that one looks at and says, not only are these religious people, but they're also noble people. Not only are they religious people, but they're also great people. Not only are they great people, but they're normal people, they're fine people, they're good to mention. It's not that often that one sees that. It's not often that one gets that feeling. And that's very, very disturbing. And perhaps this evening we'll get some understanding of this phenomenon. In the very first mitzvah given to us in the Torah as a nation is Achodesh Hazeh Lochem Rosh Chodoshim. This month, the month of Nisan, the month that we started today, should be for you the head of the months. Ask the Ramban, why does it say Lochem that should be for you? It should just say Achodesh Hazeh Rosh Chodoshim. This month is the first of the months. So Rashi deals with it in one way, with the Medrash that Hashem showed Moshe, the new moon and so on. The Ramban deals with it very differently. It means, says the Rambam, Sheyimnu Oiso Yisrael Chodesh HaRishon, that we should call Nisan the first month. Umimenu Yimnu Kol HaChodoshim Sheini Yushlishi Atashlum HaShono B'Shnei Masal Chodesh, and all the other months should be named by number. So Nisan is the first month, and Iyar is the second month, and Sivan is the third month, all the way through to Adar, which is the twelfth month. Why? Kedeshi Yezeh Zikoron Beneis HaGodol, so that we should remember the wonderful miracles of Yitzias Mitzrayim. Ki b'chol eis shenazkir achodoshim yeh hanes niska, because whenever we'll mention the months, we'll remember the miracle, because we'll be counting how many months from Nisan. Means every time you write down the date, you'll be remembering how many months, you'll be remembering the concept of counting from Nisan, from Pesach. First month, second month, third month. So you ask third from what? The third of what? It's not the beginning of the year. In the secular date, if you write the third month, you know it's March, because that's the third month of the year. But Nisan is not the first month of the year. Nisan is the seventh month of the year. So why are you calling the seventh month of the year Chodesh HaRishon, the first month? Says the Ramban, so that you remember. Each time you'll say it, you'll remember Pesach, you'll remember Yitzias Mitzrayim. That's why the months are not given names in the Torah. Always you'll see all the psukim, whenever a month is referred to in the Torah, it's referred to by its number, how many months from Nisan it is. Like the days of the week, for the same reason. We don't have Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. We have Yom Rishon, Yom Sheni, Yom Shlishi. First day, second day, third day, fourth day. First from what? From Shabbos. Second from what? From Shabbos. Third from what? From Shabbos. So really, we should say, when we say what day of the week it is, we should say as we do when we say the Shir Shel Yom. Rishon b'Shabbos, Sheni b'Shabbos, Shlishi b'Shabbos. It's the third day from Shabbos. So that we always remember, whenever we use a day of the week, whenever we refer to a date, we tune into to Shabbos. How many days since Shabbos it is? And that reminds us of all the essence of Shabbos. So the months remind us about Pesach, and the days remind us about Shabbos, which is Ma'aseh Bereishis, the creation of the world. And with those two awarenesses, we're able to focus properly. So objectively, it isn't the first month. That's why it says, "Achirish hazeh lochem she'enenu rishon b'shono." It's not the first of the year. Avalu rishon lochem, for you consider it the first. Shenikra leil zichron gulosenu. Call it the first month, even though it isn't the first month. That's why it says lochem. This will be for you the first month. You make it the first month. You call it the first month, so that you remember the miracles. So where do the names of the months come from? Nisan, Iyar, Siv, and Tammuz, where do they come from? The months came with us from Bavel. These are Babylonian terms, they're not Hebrew words. Because in the beginning, we didn't have dates for them, we didn't have names for them. So why is that? Up until the redemption from Babylon, the intention was to remember Mitzrayim. Aval kasher olinu mi bovel v'niskayim ma she'omar akosu v'lo yomar oid chai Hashem ha-shehelos b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim ki im chai Hashem ha-shehelo v'ashehevis b'nei Yisrael me'eretz tzofen. The Novi Yirmiyo says that there will come a time where people will no longer say, this is the nation that God took out of Egypt. And they will start saying, this is the nation that God took out from the northern lands. The northern lands, says the Ramban, is Babylon. So we became known as the people who came out of Babylon rather than the people who came out of Mitzrayim. Chozarnu likra achadoshim b'shem shenikroim b'eretz Bovel lahazkir kishom omadnu misham heilonu Hashem Yisbarach. So now we use the Babylonian name to remember that Hashem took us out of Babylon. So there were two geulas so far, and there will be a third, but the third we're not referring to. Up until the time of coming out of Babylon after the rebuilding of the second Beis HaMikdosh, we used to call the months by their numbers to remember Pesach, to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim. From the time of Babylon, though, from the second temple, we started calling them by their Babylonian names to remember that the Ribbono Shel Olam took us out of Babel. Important Ramban this. Ki Eile Hashemus Nisan Iyar V'Zalosim Shemos Parsim. These names, Nisan, Iyar, Siv, and they're Persian names. And you'll only find them in the Torah, in the books of the Nevi'im of Bavel, of the prophets of Babylon, and in Esther. That's what the Ramban says. In that case, it's rather interesting. It comes out that there is an aspect of Yetzias Bavel that is greater than Yetzias Mitzrayim. That after we came out of Babylon and rebuilt the second temple, that redemption eclipsed the redemption from Mitzrayim. Yes, we still say Zechel Yetzias Mitzrayim and Kiddush, and a lot of the mitzvahs we do, the Ramban says elsewhere, are in order to remember Mitzrayim. It's still a very important part of our culture, and it's a very important part of our religion and of our national consciousness. But in certain respects, the coming out of Babylon eclipsed the coming out of Mitzrayim. That there is an aspect of the coming out of Babylon that was even greater than the coming out of Mitzrayim. And that's confirmed, in fact, in the Gemara in Shabbos Daf Peches. The Gemara says, "Vayisyatzvu betachtis ha'har." When the Bnei Yisrael came to Har Sinai, it says, and they stood, the way it's translated is at the foot of the mountain, but that's not the correct translation. Betachtis ha'har means they stood under the mountain. How could they have stood under the mountain, says the Gemara? Omer Ravdimi Barchama Barchasa Melamed Shekofo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Aleim Esahor Kigigis. Ribbono Shel Olam turned the mountain over and held it, suspended it over them like a barrel. V'omer Aleim, and he said, I'm giving you a choice. Do you want the Torah or don't you? But let me just explain the offer I'm making to you. Im Atem Mekablim HaTorah Mutav. If you say yes, you want the Torah, that's a good choice. V'im Lav, but if you say no, you'll be buried under this mountain. Now you have a free choice. Please tell me what you prefer.
Omer Rav Acha bar Yaakov, Mikan Medor Rabba Lo Raisa. So Rav Acha bar Yaakov says, that's fantastic, that gives us a wonderful excuse. When we do anything wrong, we can always say to the Ribbono Shel Olam, you know, it wasn't, had you not held the mountain over me, I wouldn't have chosen it. You forced me to take to accept the Torah, so fine, I accepted it and I do my best to keep it, but I slip up occasionally, it's not my fault, it's your fault for forcing me. Omer Rav says, Rav, that won't work. Afal Pikein Hado Kiblua Bimei Hodu Kiblua Bimei Achashverosh. In the time of Achashverosh, the Bnei Yisrael re-accepted voluntarily the Torah. Dichtiv Kiyemu Bikiblu HaYehudim, because it says the Jews affirmed what they had affirmed and received. But the way the Gemara learns it is Kiyemu Mashi Kiblu Kfar. They affirmed that which they had already accepted. They accepted it by force, and now they affirmed that acceptance. Says Rashi, Bimei Achashverosh, why in the time of Achashverosh did they do that? Me ahavos hanes shenase lohem, out of a love of the miracle that was done for them. So because they were saved in the time of Purim, they loved the miracle so much that they accepted the Torah voluntarily again. So you've got no excuses. We can't say anymore that the Torah was forced upon us because we voluntarily accepted it at the time of Purim. And that's interesting, because there were some pretty dramatic miracles that happened at Mitzrayim as well. And the implication in Rashi is we didn't love those miracles. We were quite grateful for those miracles and they got us out of Mitzrayim and thank you very much, but we didn't love them. Why we didn't love them? Because we were living in Mitzrayim as well, and people become conditioned. You might say, slavery, how did they manage? How did they cope? People can become conditioned. It's like the example that they always give of the frog. If you throw it into boiling water, it dies. But if you put it into cold water and you slowly heat the water, it survives in boiling water. But if you turn the pressure up slowly, people are able to adapt amazingly well, like frogs. And in Mitzrayim as well, when one comes, there are all sorts of examples of that. That the time that they really classified the syndrome was with Patty Hearst. Remember Patty Hearst falling in love with her captors? And they've studied that and found that that's a normal occurrence. That not only is there an acclimatization to one's condition, but people even become quite comfortable with it and don't necessarily want to leave. There are people who are released from jail who actually don't want to leave. They're quite threatened by the discomfort of having to face society out there. So when we were taken out of Mitzrayim, yeah, it was quite nice. We became free, but we weren't in love with the miracles. We weren't all that excited. Whereas in the case of Purim, we were threatened with death. The choice with the miracle saved us not from slavery, they saved us from death. And then that we loved. That the miracles came and saved our lives, that we loved. So the love of the miracle of Purim was greater than the love of the miracle of Pesach. Although the miracles of Pesach were more dramatic, we felt more emotional about the miracles of Purim than we did about the miracles of Pesach. And at Purim we voluntarily accepted the Torah, which were forced upon us by the drama of the moment. At Pesach time, at Purim time, we were more actively involved in that choice. And that was the difference. It comes out that in fact the people of the second temple had a higher level to some degree than the people of the first temple. That the people of the second temple had accepted the Torah out of love, whereas the people of the first temple had accepted the Torah out of fear. And clearly love is greater than fear, so there is an element, there is an aspect of greatness in the generations of the second temple that exceeds the generations of the first, which confirms the Ramban's view. That is why we call the months by their Persian names, because the miracle of coming out of Persia was done on a higher level. We participated more actively. Coming out of Egypt, God was active and we were passive. Coming out of Bavel, we were much more active, we were much more involved. We loved the miracles, we loved the Ribbono Shel Olam, we voluntarily accepted the Torah. So there was a much higher degree of volition, there was a much higher degree of participation, and therefore there were aspects of that Yetzirah, there were aspects of that redemption that were higher and more fantastic than the redemption from Mitzrayim. And that's why we call the months by their Persian names. But that goes in contrast with the whole principle of Yiridas Hadoiris. Where do we find a situation where later generations are greater than earlier generations? Occasionally, one generation, you can get a bit of an inconsistency. But if you look over a period of time, as we come further and further from Matan Torah, as we travel in time, further and further away from the source of the giving of Torah, so we decline, we become less clear, we become less pure, we become more exposed to all sorts of things. And the result of that there is a diminishment of stature that takes place as time proceeds. Unlike in secular particularly in technology, where the opposite is the case. From a technological point of view, our knowledge thousands of years ago was minimal, and every day we're discovering new things, and it's growing exponentially. Now the rate of progress is much faster than it was a few years ago. In a few years' time, it will still be faster. So technology, we're moving from a zero base to an infinite base. But with Torah, it's exactly the opposite. We reach the infinite at Sinai. The maximum of our knowledge and our clarity and our understanding of Torah was at Sinai. That was the infinite. And we're moving from an infinite to a zero base. So whereas in technology, we're moving from zero to infinite, in Torah, we're moving from infinite to zero. Which is quite a worrying thought, and that's why we're going to need Mashiach at some time or other to uplift us. And here we see the opposite. Here we see that the generations up until the time of the destruction of the first temple lacked a quality which the later generations had. That up until that time, their whole acceptance of the Torah there was a degree of compulsion which spoiled the purity and the joy and the participation of the acceptance of the Torah, whereas the later generation, the generation of the second temple, had that dimension. So there is an element, there is an aspect that later generation, or those later generations, many of them, had, which the earlier generations didn't have. Furthermore, we see clearly in the Gemara, though, that it isn't so. Firstly, there was prophecy during the time of the first temple. There wasn't prophecy during the time of the second temple. And we find that during the time of the first temple, there were only relatively few Kohanim Gedolim. They survived. They were great Kohanim Gedolim, and they lived a long time. In the time of the second temple, especially towards its end, every year there was a new Kohen Gadol, because they couldn't survive Yom Kippur. They weren't great enough to be able to perform the Yom Kippur service properly, and they used to die. So it's difficult to see that we consider the people of the second temple greater than the ones of the first temple. Furthermore, there's a lovely Gemara in the Yuma and Daf Nun Dalet that says, "Omar Rav Katina, b'shor shoyu Yisrael oilin l'rega, when the Jews used to come up on Yom Tov to Yerushalayim, megalin lohem es ha-pareches, we used to draw the curtain in the temple, umarin lohem es ha-kruvim, and we used to show them the angels on top of the Oron, those two carved angels on top of the ark, shoyu m'urim ze b'ze, that were hugging one another. When Yisrael was doing well, the angels used to, the angel and the ark used to face each other, communicate with each other, embrace each other. The oimrim lohem, and we used to say to them, they used to say to the Jewish people, Ru'u chibaschem lifnei hamokim, look how Hashem loves you. Kechibas zochor and akevo, like a male and female, embracing one another. That's the intimacy of relationship between you and Hashem. Look how He loves you. We used to reveal that to them, we used to show them the angels on top of the Oron. Mativ Rav Chista asks Rav Chista, but we have a din in the Torah that when the Levim in the desert used to carry the various different utensils of the Beis Hamikdash, they were not allowed to see them in their places, in their positions. We didn't allow them to come. You can't compare, says the Gemara, when a kala is still, she's had the erusin. In the old days, the marriage service used to be divided into two. The erusin, the giving of the ring, used to take place a year before the rest of the marriage. So it was like an engagement period, but they were properly married during that time. But she used to stay at home with her parents. So says the Gemara, when a kala is staying at home with her parents, there's a certain distance between her and her husband and her chosam. There's a lack of intimacy. Once she moves into their home, she's intimate with him. She feels comfortable. When the children of Israel were coming out of Egypt, they didn't yet have intimacy with Hashem. And so we couldn't show them these angels. They couldn't handle it. But during the time of the first temple, they were intimate with Hashem already. They were living with Hashem. They were close to Hashem like a husband and wife. And they were able to be exposed to that aspect of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Mativ Rav Chana bar Rav Ketina Ma'ase b'Kohen Echad Sheyo Misasek. So then the Gemara asks, but there was a case of a particular Kohen who reported that there was a tile that had lifted inside the Beis Hamikdash, and they realized that he'd seen the Oron or knew where the Oron was, and he died soon afterwards. Amalei Nisgal Shukamis Nisgal Shechosur Lechiboso Harishoino. You're talking after the divorce. This is a now there's still a further stage. So you've got the time the Kala is in her parents' home. They're not intimate. then there's a period of intimacy. Then if they get divorced and remarried again, then during that remarriage, in the beginning of the remarriage period, there's again a lack of intimacy. There's a certain discomfort with one another. They've got to find their way around a little bit. And so at the time of the second temple, that was again, there was lacking, there wasn't the intimacy. So it was only in the first temple period that there was intimacy between the Bnei Yisrael and Hashem, between the Jewish people and God, sufficiently to enable the Jewish people to freely see the Kruvim on the Oren. And Avraham Grudzinski uses this as a proof that the people of the first of the first temple were on a much higher level than the people of the second temple. So how do we handle this contradiction? On the one hand, the generations of the second temple accepted the Torah voluntarily, whereas the generations of the first temple had it forced upon them. And yet, on the other hand, we see that and that's why, says the Ramban, we use the Persian months. After the coming out of Persia, we use the Persian months, not the counted months the way the Torah uses them, because we want to refer to the coming out of Persia, out of Babel, which was a much greater, the Jewish people were on a greater level in a sense than they were when they came out of Egypt. On the other hand, there's Yiridas HaDoros. We know that generations deteriorate, and that's confirmed by the Gemara in Yuma, that the people of the second temple were not as great as the people of the first temple. So we have a contradiction here. And Avraham Grudzinski explains the contradiction. And he explains on the basis of a Gemara further on in Yuma, where the Gemara says, after the destruction of the first temple, the Anshe Knesset HaGdolah had a look at things and saw why the temple was destroyed and said, why did Hashem give us the Yetzer Hara? Why did Hashem do it? Surely to give us schar, to give us more reward, that by overcoming the Yetzer Hara, we get more reward for the mitzvahs that we do, or for resisting the temptation to do wrong, we get more reward. And they said, we're prepared to forego the Yetzer Hara, and we're prepared to forego the reward for it. Let's rather not have the reward than not have the Yetzer Hara, if this is the kind of destruction it can bring. Let's rather cut it out. And they prayed to the Ribbono Shel Olam to remove or to diminish the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zorah and for Gilui Arayos, the Yetzer Hara for idol worshipping and for immorality, to diminish it, to reduce it, so that it wouldn't be quite as great. Explains Rabbi Avraham Grudzinski that with the diminished Yetzer Hara, we were dealing with diminished people. If you diminish the range of Bechira, if you diminish the range of choice that a person has, you're diminishing the stature of the individual. People get great by exercising. People become great by handling challenges. By removing the challenges or limiting the challenges, you're limiting the stature of the people. You're limiting the strength of the people. You're limiting the personality of the people. You're creating smaller people. And so says Rabbi Avraham Grudzinski, a fascinating idea. The people of the second temple were greater in some respects and were smaller in other respects. Let's have a look and see in what were they greater and in what were they smaller. The Gemara says, and also in Yuma and Daftes, Mikdash Rishon Mipnei Ma'achorev. Why was the first Beis HaMikdash destroyed? Answers the Gemara, Mipnei Shloisho Dvorim Shehoyu Bo. Because of three things that existed in society at that time. Avodah Zorah, V'Gilui Arayos, U'Shfichas Domim. There was idol worshipping, there was immorality, and there was murder at that time. And the Gemara proves what it means by that. Ask the Gemara, so what about the second temple? The second temple, they were involved with Torah and with mitzvahs, and there was a lot of gemilus chesed, there was a lot of kindness taking place. Why did that get destroyed? Answer the Gemara, because there was unnecessary hatred. People despised each other unnecessarily. L'lameidecho, to teach you, sheshekulo sinas chinam keneged sholosh averus, avodah zorah, gilui arayos, u'shfichas domim. That the Ribbono Shel Olam regards sinas chinam as seriously as the three cardinal averus put together. Sinas chinam, hating a person without reason, is as serious as idolatry, immorality, and murder put together. That's what the Gemara says. Somebody whistles. Something to whistle at. Something to whistle at. That's, I like that kind of response. It means somebody understands the Gemara. Somebody understands the Gemara. Somebody understands the impact of the Gemara. It's It's so funny, we learn so selectively today. We learn the things that we feel comfortable learning, and we manage to evade so beautifully the things that we don't feel comfortable learning. This is not a comfortable thing to learn. It's much more comfortable to learn how important it is, all the things that we do, the Shabbos that we keep, and the Kashrus that we keep, and the Yom Tov that we keep, and to go to Shiurim. We feel comfortable learning that's important, because we feel comfortable observing it. It's easy to observe, it's the fashion to observe it at the moment as well, and to think that even by keeping to the fashion we're doing well as well, that's a fantastic feeling, so we like learning that. To learn that sinas chinam, that to despise somebody without reason, is as serious as the three cardinal averas put together, that's not something we feel too comfortable about. So we don't learn it, that's all. Very often you'll hear this Gemara quoted, but you'll very seldom hear it quoted with that last line. And I promise you that last line is in the Gemara, I didn't make it up. Usually you'll hear people saying, yeah, the first temple was destroyed for the three cardinal averas, and the second temple for sinas chinam. How many people have heard that before? Put up your hand. How many have heard that? Look, a whole lot of people. How many of you have heard the last line? To teach you that sinas chinam is as serious as all three. How many people have heard? See the selective learning? We are taught and we're learning what we feel comfortable, and we're not being exposed to what we really need to know. Well, that says a lot. It's censored learning is taking place. Censored learning and censored teaching. People are being dished out selective diets. They're being told what people want them to know and what they feel comfortable knowing. They're not being told the truth, because the truth is not comfortable with. And if we told everybody the truth, perhaps it wouldn't be quite so fashionable to be frum, because the demands are much greater than they appear to be. So what do we see here? We see that this balance we're going to talk about. Why is sinas chinam as serious as the three cardinal averas? That we're going to talk about. But on the surface it would appear that the people of the first temple were worse. Avodah Zorah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Domim. The second temple, they were oiskim b'Torah and doing mitzvahs and gemilus chasodim, the Gemara says. They were involved in Torah, they were doing kindness, they were keeping the mitzvahs, they were very frum in the time of the second temple. So it would appear that the people, again, that the people of the second temple were greater. So it explains about Avrom Grudzinski, that isn't so. Because if you look at further on in the Gemara says, which of them were better? So okay, we said to show that the two are equally weighted, but still, which of them were better? Answers the Gemara, Biro Techiach. The Beis HaMikdash answers that question. You can see very simple. 70 years after the first temple was destroyed, it was rebuilt again. We're still waiting for the second temple to be built. So if you look at the length of the exile, that should tell you which is more serious. When was the second temple destroyed? How many years ago? 2,000 years ago nearly, isn't that so? What's the ratio of 70 to 2,000 in percentages? How much more is 2,070? About 30 times. So even if the Beis HaMikdash were rebuilt today, we can say that the people of the second temple, or the first temple, were 30 times better than the people of the second temple. Now look at that. I mean, if I would say this kind of thing and it wasn't in the Gemara, I would be excommunicated. I'd probably be excommunicated even though it is in the Gemara. Look at the description of the people of the first. If I told you, there is a community in Johannesburg, let us say I told you that, whose people serve idolatry, and they murder, and they're immoral. There is another community that are oiskim b'Torah, they learn the Torah, and b'mitzvahs, they do mitzvahs, and gemilus chasodim, and they do kindness to one another. The only thing is that in the first one, nobody hates anybody else without reason. They live and let live. They've got no tainas, no machlokes, and either they get on with their idolatry, and they get on with their immorality, and they get on with their murder, but they only murder people who they feel deserve to be murdered. They don't have no small petty machlokes. They let other communities live, they feel quite comfortable. But the other community that's oiskim b'Torah and begimuz chasodim and in mitzvahs, they're sinas chinam. They say nasty things about one another, and they say nasty things about other communities, and they undermine people. And I told you that according to the Gemara, the happy-go-lucky community is 30 times more righteous is at least 30 times more righteous than the Frum community. Can you imagine me being excommunicated? Of course I would be excommunicated. How can you say such a thing? It's a Gemara. That's what the Gemara says. That's what we're meant to learn from it. And yeah, we feel uncomfortable. It's not a comfortable thought. It's a very discomforting thought, because we're dealing with immeasurables. When you're dealing with measurables, it's easy. When Yiddishkeit in our mind is a matter of keeping kosher and keeping Pesach and keeping Shabbos and counting Sfiras HaOmer and making brachos before we eat and wearing tzitzis, and those are all measurables, we can deal with them. Some more effectively, some less effectively, but we can deal with them. When we talk about Sinas Chinom, those are emotional things. That's very difficult. And that's what we're saying, that's what the Gemara is saying. So explains Rav Rom Grudzinski, the deeds of the people of the first temple were not as great as the deeds of the people of the second temple. But the people of the first temple were greater than the people of the second temple. Follow the difference. So we have in the generation of the first temple, great people doing naughty things. In the second temple, we had little people doing good things. That's the difference. And the Anshe Knesset HaGedolah knew when they removed the challenges of the Yetzirah of Avodah Zarah and Gilui Arayos, when they removed that Yetzirah, they knew they were going to be diminishing the stature of the people. And we'll discuss in a moment why they did it. But that was the impact of removing the challenge. When you isolate yourself from challenge, you become a small person. There's no question about that. That's life. That might mean you do better things, but you're a smaller person. So we're beginning, this is so relevant to our own time. We started off with that observation. When a person becomes religious, what does he do? He starts isolating himself from challenges. And I'm not even talking about Yetzer Hara and about doing things that one shouldn't do, Chas V'Shalom. I'm not talking about that at all. But as his life becomes more restricted, and he starts cutting out interactions and interrelationships, and he doesn't read what he used to read, and I'm not talking about reading forbidden things, I'm talking about reading healthy things. Even healthy things he isn't reading. He knows very little about what's going on in the world. He's not up to date with science and technology. He's not up to date with philosophy. He's not up to date with art and literature. He doesn't know where the world is going. So he's working on a much narrower area, and the reduction in challenge diminishes his personality. But he's doing good things that he didn't used to do before. Before he used to eat treif, now he's eating kosher. Before he was a mechalel Shabbos, now he's a shomer Shabbos. Before he didn't wear his tzitzis, now he is wearing his tzitzis. Before she didn't cover her hair, now she is covering her hair. The actions are greater and the people are smaller. So the observation is not incorrect. Then we have to go a little bit further in our analysis and say, how does that affect with the Sinas Chinam? Explains Rav Rom Grudzinski that Sinas Chinam, what does it mean, Sinas Chinam? The Gemara says these people were outstanding in Gemilus Chasodim. What does the Gemara say? Aval Mikdash Sheni, the second temple, Shehoyu Oiskim BaTorah, they used to deal in Torah. Not the way we learn, the way the Gemara wants people to learn. Oiskim BaTorah. Really, genuinely, they were learning Torah. All the mitzvahs, they were doing mitzvahs. Ugmilus Chasodim, and they were doing Gemilus Chesed. Mipnei Ma Chorev, why was it destroyed? Mipnei Shoeso Boi Sinas Chinam. Because there was unnecessary hatred. How can it be unnecessary hatred if they were doing Sinas Chinam? Says Rav Rom Grudzinski, this is weird. They accepted the Torah out of more love than the earlier ones did. So they love Hashem more than the earlier ones did. From love of God comes love of man. And they were doing Chesed, so they must have been love of man as well. So the Chesed was great. Where does the Sinas Chinam come? Where does the unnecessary hatred come from? Explains Rav Rom Grudzinski, when little people do great deeds, the objective specifications of the deeds are great. But there's no soul to them. There's no heart to them. That's the danger. When a great person does something, it's not just the specifications that are right. It has soul, it has heart, it has passion, it has meaning, it has depth. It has a spiritual side to it. When a small person does something, he might conform to the specifications of the deed. He says his kiddush correctly. His tzitzis are kosher. The food he eats is mahadrin. Everything conforms to absolute clear specifications. But if he's a small person, the soul is missing, the soul is lacking. What he's able to put into the action is very limited. And when you've got gemilus chesed, when you've got kindness in objective specification without the soul, you run the risk of sinas chinam. You run the risk of hatred also. Sinas chinam is despising people for no reason. So you could have a situation of Gemilus Chesed where you land up doing Chesed to people who agree with you. You land up doing Chesed to people who are on the same wavelength as you. But people who are not on the same wavelength as you, you despise. You talk Lashon Hora about them. If they don't think the way you think, and they don't act the way you act, and they don't believe exactly the way you believe, if they don't belong to your precise school of thought, you're willing to write them off. They're gormit, they're nothing, they're pikusim, they're rubbish, they're this, they're that, and you exclude them totally. That's sinas chinam. So small people feel comfortable with gemilus chesed when they're dealing with people who don't make them feel small. Nobody likes doing chesed to people when they feel inadequate in that interaction. If a person's a big person, he'll do chesed even with different people. It doesn't bother him. But a small person feels insecure. So he'll only do chesed with people who conform to his ideas of how people are supposed to be. And that's where the sinas chinam comes in. So he excels in chesed. He does wonderful kindness to some people and unnecessarily hates other people. So the objective specifications are in place, but the meaning of it all isn't in place. The soul and heart of it isn't in place. And explains about Ron Grudzinski, that's the danger of small people, of being small people. It's not that it's a plain sailing path to doing things right and to doing things correctly, not at all. The danger is that we do things correctly only on the external, but we lack the feeling, we lack the passion, we lack the soul. And that really is the situation in which we find ourselves in today. That people have to make a decision. And different individuals should make their own decisions, because this varies from individual to individual. The decision is, how much am I going to restrict myself? In the process of being religious, how much am I going to restrict myself? And again, I'm not talking about restricting oneself from doing things that aren't allowed. I'm talking about restricting oneself even from things that are allowed. Or in the process of becoming religious. There is a process. There are things which are allowed for a person at a certain stage of his development, which he wouldn't have an interest in doing at a later stage of his development. The great Rav Shach asked me, what do people in your community do on Shabbos? I said, what do you mean, what do they do? They come to shul. He says, yeah, but in their spare time, a long Shabbos in the summer, what do the women do? He said, if they can't learn, nor should they be learning. That's not the idea. Fine. The husbands are probably quite tired. They've had a difficult week. They go to shul. They come home, they're pretty tired. Maybe they even go back to shul for a shir. What do the women do? He says, because the frum people today, they wouldn't read. He says, do they read Dickens? Do they read Shakespeare? So I said, no, they don't. He said, why not? So what do they do? They talk Lashon Hara probably. He says, what do they do? What is left for them to do? The process of becoming, and he was very concerned. He was saying, and what he was saying is that since the trend is, the moment they start becoming religious, the first thing they do is slam the gates on their old life. And they exclude the good and the bad. Everything's out. So even classics of literature they don't read anymore. And they're not yet ready to read classics of Torah. And if they're ready to read the classics of Torah, they're not ready to really enjoy them. Yeah, so you've got English translations and you can read them and you can go through the motions of learning. As Rabbi von Grzynski says here, the objective criteria are there. You learnt, you read the art scrolls of the Parsha, or you read the Medrash says, you read some stuff. Did you really get excited? Did you really use your mind to challenge yourself and to plumb the depths of an interesting idea? No, one doesn't have the knowledge to do that yet. And what about reading something that is secular but kosher? No, that we wouldn't do, because we're now religious, we don't, that part of our life is gone. So what is left, he was saying? What is left? The small-mindedness that is left. There's not an opportunity for expansion. And he was discussing with it from a point of view of concern. So what does one do about it? Now, I don't remember if I've told some of you the story, certainly, of when my father went to yeshiva for the first time. His uncle, Rebbe Lopian, said to him, the first opportunity you have, you must go to Kelm and you must meet Reb Daniel. You'll enjoy him. He's a great tzaddik of the time, great Godel Hador. go to him and give him regards from me and get to know him. He's a person who will take an interest in you and he'll train you and you need to get to know him. Which he did. So the first time he had a holiday from the yeshiva, he prepared the piece of Gemara thoroughly. He stayed up night after night to know it well so that he would have something to talk to Reb Daniel about. And he goes off to Reb Daniel all excited and nervous, sits down. And Reb Daniel says, "Where are you from?" He says, "From South Africa." "That's interesting. Where did you have your schooling?" He says, "In South Africa." He said, "Did you matriculate?" He said, "Yes." He said, "What was your Shakespeare set with?" So my father said it was King Lear. So he said, "Ah, King Lear, good, let's discuss King Lear." And he started testing him on King Lear, and he showed him very quickly that the way he was taught, he missed the essential elements of the whole play. He really didn't understand what it was all about. He reconstructed the whole play for him, excited him unbelievably. When he went out of the Neil, he got hold of an old copy of King Lear and read it through and saw all the brilliance of it. He was amazed. So the next holiday, before he goes back to Reb Daniel, he prepares Hamlet. He goes off to and he goes off to Reb Daniel, and he's ready now with Hamlet. Absolutely ready. He knows it by heart. So Reb Daniel says, "No, what Gemara have you been learning?" So he said, "I don't understand. Last time I came prepared with Gemara and you questioned me on King Lear. This time I came prepared with Hamlet and you're questioning me on Gemara." So Reb Daniel said, "Last time you were new in yeshiva, I wanted to get to know you in an area that you felt confident. I wanted to see how you're thinking. I couldn't question you in Gemara. You don't know how to think in Gemara yet. So it would have been unfair. I wouldn't have got to know you. So I got to know you by talking in an area that you're confident. But now that you've been learning for a while already, I can talk to you in Gemara. There's no need to talk to you in King Lear or in Hamlet." What's interesting about the story is that Reb Daniel knew Shakespeare inside out. That's what's interesting about the story. He knew Shakespeare inside out. Completely at home in it. Rav Abramsky, the great Gogol Rav Abramsky, used to sit and speak to anybody who came to see him from any profession. The conversation always started in the area of that person's profession. That's where he would start. The person sat down, Rav Abramsky would start talking to him about if it was a doctor, it was in medicine. If it was a specialist, it was in his specialized area in medicine. If he was a psychologist, it was in psychology. If he was a professor of English literature, it was in literature. If he was an anthropologist, it was in anthropology. Whatever area the person dealt in, that's where the discussion started. And when people used to come out of Rav Abramsky, of a session with Rav Abramsky, they used to comment on how unbelievably knowledgeable he is in their area. That's the breadth of these people. That's great people. Today we're dealing with small people. People who don't have that breath. They're scared of that breath. And the question an individual has to ask them is, how far is it necessary for me to narrow myself? And different people have to answer it in different ways. You can't standardize it. There's some people have to say, I want nothing to do with my old life. If I just read even a Dickens or a Shakespeare, I'm going to get out of learning Torah. I'm going to be back in my old life and all that. I can't have anything to do with it. It's too dangerous. And you can have other people who are very comfortable with it, and it's not a big deal, it's not a big problem. On the contrary, they're able to integrate it, and they like to integrate it. Each person has to decide how far he's going to challenge himself with diverse experience within the realm of what's okay, certainly at his particular stage of development. And that's his decision that he makes. He doesn't have to take the decision from what other people are doing. Each person has to determine his own level. But what's important is, if he decides that it's necessary for him to restrict himself, he's got to know what the danger is. Some people think that the safe route is to restrict yourself. And from one point of view, that's safe. You're not challenged. But from another point of view, that's not safe at all. Because as you become a smaller and smaller person, you lose the insight, you lose the passion, you lose the depth, you lose the neshama, you lose the soul of your very Yiddishkeit. You don't lose the soul of Shakespeare, you lose your soul of Yiddishkeit. Because you're not a big person. By removing the Yetzer Hara of Gilui Arayos and Avodah Zarah, the generation became smaller. The removing of that challenge made them smaller. And if one opts for the smaller option, one needs to know the danger. The danger is Sinas Chinam. The danger is, yes, very nice frum community, but Sinas Chinam, unnecessary hatred. That's the danger. The danger is smallness. The danger is resentment of other people. The danger is jealousy. The danger is undermining. The danger is machlokes. The danger is lashon hara. These are the dangers. They're massive dangers. And look how dangerous they are. That 30 times as great was the first one than the second generation. But the people who were doing Gilui Arayos and Shvichas Dorim and Avodah Zarah, 30 times as great as the ones who only had Sinas Chinam. Because in the case of Sinas Chinam, it's the soul of the Torah that's missing. In the case of the first one, they were doing wrong actions, but they had the soul. In the second base Hamikdash, they were doing the right actions, but they had no soul. And that's the risk of minimizing oneself. That's the risk of narrowing oneself. And one might opt for that risk, and I'm not suggesting that there are many people who ought to opt for that, but not being totally non-cognizant that the fact is that there's a risk there as well. The fact that you're removing the Yetzirah of doing all sorts of other things, that's very nice, but you're introducing a new Yetzirah. You're introducing the Yetzirah of minimizing the soul of the very Torah that we're living and practicing. That we have to watch out for. And that one has to take measures to avoid happening. How do we ensure that if we're living narrow lives, we make sure that we're not becoming narrow people? Very difficult. On the other hand, if we're living broad lives, how do we make sure that they're Torah lives? That's the challenge of living. Constantly having to make those choices and those decisions and finding the level at which one's comfortable to be living a Torah life which is broad. A Torah life which is as pure as we're able to live and as broad as we're able to live. And balancing or juggling the breadth of life with the purity of life is the true challenge of what Torah living is all about. And if it's so serious, the consequence of narrowing is so serious, Rabbi Avraham Grudzinski asks, why then did the Anshei Knesset HaGdola do it? Why didn't they leave the Yetzirah there? Fine, so they would carry on with murder, and they would carry on in their happy way with Shvichus Domim, murder, and Avodah Zorah, and Gilui Arayos, but they're great people. Why did they interfere with the greatness of the people in order to get purity of action? And he goes through a discussion which we don't have time to follow all the way through, but his point is that it wasn't they who did it. They were merely responding to what had already happened. What had already happened, and he brings a Rashi in Shir HaShirim in the sixth perek on the posuk of Hasibeni Enayich Minegdi Shehem Hirivuni. You have removed your eyes from opposite me because they made me broad. They made me arrogant. Hashem removes himself from us. What does it mean? Explains Rashi. Kachu amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'mikdash zeh I efshar lahashiv lochem oroin v'chapuris ukruvim. In the second base HaMikdash, I cannot allow you to have the oroin, the kapuris, and the kruvim, those same angels that people used to come and have a look at in the first base HaMikdash. You won't have it in the second one. Why not? Sheheim hirhivuni b'vayis rishon laharoischem chibo yisera. Because they caused you to become arrogant. In the first temple where you had that intimacy with me, and I showed you this love, ad shemo altimbi, you finally rejected me. Sometimes there's too much intimacy. And so I've got to withdraw myself. And here we get an understanding of Yiridas HaDoiris. Yiridas HaDoiris is where we can no longer handle the intimacy. And so Hashem moves a little further. Sometimes one gets close to a person, and that closeness destroys the relationship. If it's a strange thing, it's a funny thing. Sometimes distance is destructive, and sometimes intimacy is destructive. And that's why one needs a balance between them. That's why in a Jewish marriage, there's intimacy and distance built into the system. So that one isn't permanently intimate, nor is one permanently distant. That there's an ebb and a tide, that there's a coming and a going. Because a permanently intimate relationship is as destructive as a permanently distant relationship. It says Hashem, during the first Beis HaMikdash, we were permanently intimate. And that damaged you. So I've got to remove myself a little bit. And the removing that distance makes us smaller people. Or that distance makes us less able to handle the Yetzirah. When we were with the first temple and God was evident and God was obvious, we could handle the Yetzirah a little bit better. But now that God's presence has become more subtle, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola said, we can no longer handle that same intensity of Yetzirah. If God has distanced himself, he has to diminish the Yetzirah, otherwise the world is loses its balance. So who started the process? We did. Because we rejected God during the period of intimacy, he withdrew himself. As a result of withdrawing himself, we could no longer handle the Yetzirah. As a result of that, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola asked for the Yetzirah to be diminished. By diminishing the Yetzirah, we're diminishing the challenge. By diminishing the challenge, we're smaller people. By being smaller people, we've got all the problems associated with being smaller people. And so it wasn't the first choice. It wasn't as if the Anshei Knesset HaGdola said, it is better to be narrow and pure than to be broad and great. They're not saying that, and the Gemara is not saying that. The Gemara is saying the people of the first temple were 30 times better than the people of the second temple. The only thing is we couldn't handle that kind of environment anymore. And so in our environment we have a similar situation. To handle the challenges of living a normal life out in the big world, some people would find very difficult and perhaps impossible. And so they have to restrict it a little bit. What they need to know though is that by restricting that challenge, they are not removing the risk, they are simply shifting the risk. The risk is from, instead of being a risk that I won't be religious, that I won't do the correct things, that my actions will be inadequate, the risk now becomes that my actions are adequate, but there isn't feeling in them, there isn't soul in them, there isn't purpose in them, there isn't depth in them, there isn't understanding in them. If I move the other way, then I might develop the depth and I might develop the understanding and the intensity, but my actions, I might not be religious enough. And so every individual has to find his place. How broad can he allow himself to be? And we have to expand ourselves to the maximum that we can cope with. We have to be as broad as we can handle. And we have to exercise ourselves and develop ourselves to make sure that we're becoming broader, not narrower. As we're developing, we need to increase our breadth. And as we come broader, only as broad as we can handle, but always trying to increase that breadth while not compromising the purity of who we are and what we are. That's the process that has to take place. And in that process, we have to recognize that different people are different people. And that while I might choose the narrow route because that's what I feel comfortable handling, somebody else might choose the broader route because that's what he feels comfortable handling. And while I might choose the broader route, somebody else might choose the narrow route. And that's okay. And he might slip up in his narrow route, he might miss some of the depth. And I might slip up in my broader route, I might miss some of the purity. Or vice versa. And that's life, that's okay. We don't have to believe that our way is the only way. As long as each person understands himself well enough and understands the risks involved and the challenges involved and knows how to weigh them up and watch them and monitor them and adjust his life according to his success and continually attempt to expand his breadth without compromising his purity, then we'll have a situation where the actions will be great and the people will be great. There will be Oisek b'Torah uva mitzvah u'gmilus chasodim. We will learn Torah, we'll do the mitzvahs, we'll be kind to one another without sinas chinam, without any form of unnecessary hatred. We will tolerate the understanding that different people are different and different communities are different, and that's okay as long as everybody's working in a direction that is bringing them closer to doing that which is right and to being that which is great and that which is fine and that which is noble. And if we're able to achieve that, then we'll be able to combine the two redemptions, the redemption from Mitzrayim, which was where God was active, there was great purity, there was great people, but not the same degree of purity, with the second redemption, where there was great purity, but not the same greatness of stature of people. Where we're able to combine those two together, and we're able to achieve greatness of personality with purity of action, then we'll be able to set the stage for the coming of the Mashiach and the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. Just a few announcements before you go. And next Motzei Shabbos, that Shabbos HaGodol, won't be here, and therefore there won't be a Motzei Shabbos Shir. And then for the following two Motzei Shabbos, it's Pesach. So the next Motzei Shabbos Shir, will be 4 weeks' time. Is that how it works out? The next Motzei Shabbos Shir will be the first Motzei Shabbos after Pesach. Will be the next time that there's a Shir. Are there any other announcements I'm going to make? I think that's it. Thank you.